All right, folks, thanks for joining us at Little Things Are Big Things Education. This week is Motivating the Unmotivated. Our big idea, we are going to focus on both some pragmatic solutions for students who aren't seeing the purpose of school and also think about the meta conversations that we can have around why some students might not feel like they belong in our education system. Looking forward to this episode and this conversation. All right, he is back in Washington after driving across the country in like 2 days.
Three.
And is a brand new WRX. I'm sure he obeyed the speed limit the entire time.
Of course.
7 years math, 3 years challenge day. My best friend, great teacher, T-Free.
Hey, K-Dub's still kicking it in the PNW down in Portland with me. 11 years of social studies, middle school and high school. 20 years of athletics, coaching, all sorts of different stuff. My best bud, K-Dub.
Hey. How are you doing?
Thanks for listening to our Little Things Are Big Things podcast here. Little Things Are Big Things Education. You can check us out at littlebiged.com, or you can go to Peak State Mathematics, actually where I do my tutoring, technically is what is powering this in the current moment. And don't forget to rate and review us. The what?
We got to plug that tutoring work.
Oh, absolutely. I'd love it. Don't forget to rate and review us. We'd love to hear from you. And follow us on social media. We got Facebook. We got Instagram. Dave's posting on Twitter as well, I believe. Mm-hmm. Get us those 5 stars, download, all that fun stuff. So we appreciate it. And Dave, I think we're kickstarting with our Motivating the Unmotivated here in Motivation Week. What you got?
That is the big idea. And I think where we wanted to start is kind of the micro version and or the pragmatic version. We talked in the last podcast about how much words matter, so we can delineate between which one of those two. But really, like another way of thinking about this is like tangible things that you can talk to kids about how their education is valuable to them, right? Like it's like legitimately money in their pocket. And you have a really great resource that you share with your students on this, right?
I mean, of course, as a math teacher, especially with a financial background, like I'm like, where is math most important in your life? To me, my personal belief is money, business, finance. Like that's where math is going to show up the most for you after school. And so like anytime my kids start to question it, I'm like, boom, let's get math into our wallets, right? And so my kids that, you know, and I teach a lot of sophomores right now, geometry, and I've taught middle school, I've taught seniors, right? And whatever level I'm at, like there's always that conversation of this is stupid. Why do I need to even finish this? I'm just going to drop out and get a job now. Mm-hmm. And so I try to have that conversation with them, you know, for multiple reasons why that's probably not the best solution for them. I'm not going to say there's no situation where that is a good solution, because then we're speaking in absolutes, and I think that becomes a whole problem as well. So I'm going to say the majority of the time, it usually will work out better for a student in the long run to graduate, right? And I think as teachers, that's one of our goals, help students graduate, be career, college ready, all that other verbiage that we like to spout. So
yeah, one of the things that I liked about, I poked around on the survey that you're going to make available to people for their students. One thing I liked that you really focused on was like talking about like there are like success stories that don't involve these statistics, right? Like, you know, there's always outliers in these situations, and you pointing that out, I think is really like honest of you to like make sure that your students are seeing that. And like the statistics are the statistics. And one of the things that looking at your chart reminded me of is one of the things that I talked to my freshman football players about more than anybody else. I don't do it as much with my ninth grade students, which is probably an oversight on my part upon current reflection in this moment right now. But moving on.
Always reflecting.
Always reflecting. The idea that like your job as a student, and maybe job isn't the right word to use, but that's the word I've been using, is to understand that when you come into high school, it's a little bit different from person to person, right? But like thinking about particularly the students that I work with on the football team, where we're predominantly talking about white males, right? Like, every door is open to you at this point, for the most part. Or at least a hell of a lot of doors are open to you.
A lot of doors, yeah.
At this point. And your job at high school is to keep as many of those doors open for you at the end of this four-year journey as they are today. You might choose not to go through a door. Like, I'm not interested in being a doctor because blood makes me want to throw up, so I'm not going to go through that door. But to have that door available to you still when you end your process in school is really important. And what I liked about your resource is that that conversation is kind of theoretical. Yours is much more like something that you can literally feel and touch.
Right. Yeah. And so the form he's talking about, and yeah, we'll definitely throw it in the free resources for you. So go check it out and download it. Feel free to share it, modify whatever. Or if you think there's something to add to it, I'm happy to work with you. So shoot us an email. And it basically starts you off with like the national statistics of like level of education matched with annual average salary. And so you look at the different levels, and where I focused on was literally just the decision to graduate high school instead of dropping out. And so, and again, I'm working with sophomores. I do this about Christmas time because that's usually the first pushback right before winter break, where they're going to get burnt out. They don't really want to do math that last couple days going into break anyway. So this is one of those like really good life skill things to throw at them, but they're still practicing a little bit of numbers. And I'm able to get them to realize that, hey, if you choose to stay in school and finish out junior and senior year, like, you're going to basically make, and I'll let you guys go through the form, you can look at all the numbers later, basically make like $350,000 to $400,000 more in lifetime earnings, right? And the numbers, I think, just real quick, is like 38,000 on average if you graduate high school versus 30, I think, is the numbers that are national averages. And so, you know, $8,000 a year, basically for 50 years of working time from age 18 to 68, which the new Social Security retirement age is like 67, 68, somewhere in there, right? And so, you know, they got 50 years to work. That's $400,000 of lifetime earning incomes. I actually also go through some of the unemployment, and it's a little more fine-tuned than that. But still, the conversation's big picture comes back to this idea that if you were to break that down into just staying in class and doing your homework, taking your test and passing with a D, just graduate, right? Mm-hmm. D for diploma, get out the building, right? You are basically making $150 per class per day. So like $900 per day of future earning potential just by graduating, not going to college, not going to a 2-year, not getting a tech, just do the last 2 years, like $900 a day. And they're like, oh, really? And I'm like, yeah. And then of course they forget this. Like, I literally this last week, we were having this conversation right before spring break. Another one of those opportunities, the kids are starting to burn out. And like, why am I even doing this? I'm like, so you can make an extra $500,000. Like, oh yeah, you told us that, didn't you? And I was like, yeah, let's do the numbers again. And like, it's, and again, like Dave spoke to, like, obviously there's the person who's going to drop out because they have, you know, opportunities to go excel and they have their passion. They've got this incredible drive and whatever has motivated them to a level beyond the typical person, they're going to be a success. They're not going to be part of that statistic. But again, numbers are numbers for a reason. And if you are doing what the average person does, you typically will get what the average results are, right? Like, in order to be above, like, you know, abnormal, right, you got to do something that's not normal. If you want to be outstanding, you got to do that little extra. And so we have that conversation for sure. And then we have just a gut honest, you know, reaction to, no, this is what's probably going to happen, you know? So I think it's fun to see that. It gives them an actual dollar value. Even our tech department person was talking about how, like, I've seen this in a lot of different ways, but not like down to a per class just to attend junior, senior year. So yeah, it's kind of fun to look at it that way.
I love that. And one of the things that in hearing you talk, and especially keeping in mind that they're 15, 16 years old, and there are a lot of things going through their brains, and 90% of it has nothing to do with like future success or future rewards.
Right.
Thinking about how funny it would be to think about how much money that is for a week, and just every Friday, give every kid like a fake check. You finished the week. You did everything you were supposed to. Here's your
$4,500. There you
go. Here's your $4,500 check for the week, boss, because of what you did.
Yep.
I think that would be kind of fun to do for a little while. It's just like that reminder. Because we know kids need those reminders. I mean, all humans need them, but kids, especially at that high school age, have just so much going on in their lives. That would be really valuable. The other thing, and this is one of the things that I think why when we were able to work together as coaches or on anything else as a project, that I felt like we made such a dynamic team, if I can toot our horns for a second, is you're so good at like this practical, like the tangible, the math, right? The numbers, like the hard fact stuff. And then as you were talking about that, I was wondering like the whole thing that your form doesn't touch on, but I think is also really important. And this is where like the social studies skills and me come out, is think about also just like the job satisfaction of either what you're going to be doing or how far you're going to be able to climb in what you're doing.
Right.
Because even if at age 18 or 25 or 30, you don't really mind, or you actually enjoy like hands-on, like physical labor of being a landscaper or I'm trying to think of jobs like, you know, being a truck driver, potentially. I don't know what the requirements are for that at this point, but right, like these jobs that like you could get without having a high school degree, even if you enjoy that work for a period of time, there's still going to be a cap on the amount of responsibility and trust that you can gain within the people who are running that organization, more than likely. I don't know very many people that think their bosses are awesome, right? Like that's a kind of a common complaint, is a lot of people don't like, you know, there's always something about your job that's frustrating. Right. And oftentimes boss is one of them. And or having the option when your body does get tired to move on to the next thing. Even if your job's not like physically wearing, maybe you're doing a job where you need to be on your feet for 8 hours a day. Yeah, and you're going to get tired. And so having that option to do something else, and then going back to the tangible that's also related to the social studies, like we also just know those jobs are going away every year.
Right.
I don't know if anybody else out there who's listening to us has watched The Wire. Just finished season 2 the other day. It's a phenomenal show if you haven't watched it. Season 2 really highlights like people who work unloading ships and just being replaced by automation. Right? Like those are all things that we need to be aware of, and understanding that, you know, one of the guys on the show just kind of like, we used to make stuff here and we don't anymore. And I don't know that I 100% agree with that statement, but like human beings don't do a whole lot of physical labor on building things in this country. And like, I talked about the semi-truck drivers, like they're probably going to get replaced in the next generation, I would guess.
Right. Self-driving cars, all that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You've got drones that are already being trained to fly product. You don't even have delivery people anymore. Like, yeah, there's a lot of things that are going to disappear in that lower traditional education level. Right. Mm-hmm. And I try to make this clear with my students too. I think there's a lot of ways to learn, right? Mm-hmm. And this actually becomes a very real conversation. I would encourage people to have this conversation with their students too, when they're like, oh, well, you know, I'm going to start my own business and I'm going to do this, this, and the other thing, right? I was like, great. But I will argue that in order for you to do that, you are going to have to continue your education. You're going to have to read books. You're going to have to watch a ton of videos. You're going to have to attend some seminars. You're going to probably have to build a network and find some people who have done it before you so that you can gain this knowledge and not do it all on your own and learn from your own mistakes, but grow exponentially so you can get to that next income level. Because mm-hmm. even if you're making money, but you haven't learned how to do it, you're going to make massive mistakes that cost you money and still brings your overall you know, net income down, right? Because for me, at least, everything I've ever tried to do on my own without getting support from other places, and you know me, I'm an entrepreneur. I've done crazy things, right? Like I've learned a lot from making mistakes and losing money because of my mistakes,
yeah.
Right? And so what I thought was going to be a $20,000 project, I lost $15,000 on it for XYZ plus hours and hours and hours. I'm like, sweet. I made like $4 an hour to make $5,000 like over the course of what 1,200 hours or whatever that ends up being. Right. And so, yeah, it's, and they get that. They get the idea that like, oh, you're right. I am still going to have to learn. And so for me, because I like teaching lifelong learning, like that becomes a big part of this conversation is if, and if I have to get to a gut level conversation with a kid about dropping out, like I will literally be like, okay, here's your options. Like you are going to have to put in the grind yourself and learn all this stuff on your own with no support. You have to find the resources. You have to do all these things so that you can be successful or live this very mediocre lifestyle. Right. Like, yeah. And a lot of times like, oh, you're right. I don't really want to live that mediocre lifestyle. And I don't know if I'm willing to put in the grind yet. I'm like, of course you're not. You haven't practiced. Stay with me, practice the grind, figure out if you even like it, get through high school. And then you have lots of options. And like you said, keep doors open.
Yeah. Right. Cause you can go enter the workforce. You know, I had this conversation with one of my players last year who, you know, smart kid, has all the, you know, all the advantages in the world, but just doesn't like school and wanted to do something that didn't involve having to even finish school, and got a job during the pandemic and was really liking that. And I was like, man, you can always graduate high school, go do the job that you're doing for 40 hours a week instead of 20 hours a week, or whatever the limits are for a kid who's 17. And then if you decide it sucks or it gets old, or you just have a change of heart, you want something different in your life, you have the degree, you can go to community college, you can go to, you can apply for, you know, some other university system, depending on grades and things like that. Like you just keep the options open, right? Like just finish the deal so that you can have another option moving forward. And so I like this idea of like the really pragmatic, like kind of money in hand, like job, career satisfaction of finishing school or doing well in school, right? Pushing kids to be motivated. In that sense, I think there's another level of pragmatism or two that we can talk about. One that I know you and I both are closely connected to, both from our own experiences as students, but also, you know, we both coached, and that is athletics, right? Like there are a lot of kids who have reasons that, like, I don't like school, like talking about the same kid I was just talking about, but grades were always better before football season and during football season because we had rules and then there's eligibility rules and things like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, students will do things because they want to play basketball or they want to play soccer or whatever their thing is. So I think that's another really good example of a carrot that is out there for kids, is the idea of being able to do something they love that can get taken away if the grades aren't taken care of.
Right. And I think that's that balance too of like our carrot and stick idea, right? There's the, I want to play, and if I don't perform, it could be taken away. So there's the two side to that.
Yep.
I love that you talked about the idea of like grades being better in season. That was 100% true for me. every season. My worst grades was always in the winter because I had football in the fall and I had baseball in the spring, right? Mm-hmm. Winter was like my just like chill, relax, recover. We had weightlifting, right, or whatever. But like outside of
routine, right?
Like I had too much time to just goof around, you know. And like that happened for me in college too. My worst grades in college was freshman year for a lot of different reasons, right? Finally getting away from the home. I've got no rules. I gotta make all my decisions, and not all of them were good decisions. I survived them. So again, that's part of my opportunity cost and learning, you know, like probably cost me some years of my life, but I'm trying to build them back. But you know, like once I walked on and I played college football, like I had structure again. And even for me in like my life now, I notice that I am much more efficient, productive, and I show up better when I don't have 4 hours to sit around at home, but I have like rec volleyball, or, you know, like I coach or I DJ the high school sporting events. Like I've got some other commitment that keeps me more structured. And I think that Maybe it was just a pattern I picked up in high school, but I think to exactly what we're speaking about here, like having that carrot and that motivation, I think has helped make me a lifelong learner and has helped keep me motivated to do all the things I need to do, not just the things I want to do, but all the things so I can complete the big picture.
So athletics is one version of this, kind of like pragmatic, kind of tangible side of the motivating students. Another one that, like, I'm gonna like just tell my own personal story here as it relates. Like, my parents had these rules when I got to high school. I don't remember the exact language that they used, but like the story in my head is like basically got told starting high school, like first year of high school, your job is to be a student, right? And so your job performance is going to be, you have to have a 3.0. If you have a 3.0, we will provide for, you know, reasonable amount of gas money, pay for car insurance, and, you know, give you X amount of dollars to have lunch every day. Right? We had an open campus, so we, you know, went to Subway on every game day, teriyaki every Thursday, right? All those kinds of things. You know, very privileged, like really, like pretty easy situation that my parents provided for me. And my end of the deal was, got to have a 3.0. At the end of every, I think we were on trimesters at that point, right? So at the end of every trimester, I had to have a 3.0. And I think it was, to your point about backsliding, when there wasn't the structure of football and or the motivation of another adult in my life that I cared about telling me that my school was important and that I needed to do my homework. I think it was second quarter of sophomore year. Might have been third quarter or third trimester. Sorry, not quarter. I slipped, man. I had like a 2.67 or something like that. And my parents were like, all right, you got to get a job. And I argued. I was like, this doesn't make sense. I'm not doing well in school. And you want me to have more time where I'm not able to do my schoolwork? This is stupid. And they're like, no, you're going to go be a busboy at Black Angus because you didn't hold up your end of the bargain. We're not paying for the stuff that you need anymore. And you also have to have it. So you have to have a job to pay for that stuff. And you need to realize that if you don't finish school, and I didn't understand this at the time, but part of like when you're a 15-year-old, you obviously don't have a high school degree yet. It's a pretty limited number of jobs that you can be doing, and most of them suck. I don't know if anybody out there has been a busboy at a restaurant, but that is not a good time. I hated it. There were some benefits. Black Angus, you know, I got like a free loaf of bread every day, and I love the Black Angus bread and whatnot, but like for the most part, that job sucked. And it was a really good motivation to get my ass in gear, my, you know, on my grades and get things taken care of. And so I'm wondering, I'll just start with this. Did you have anything like that where your parents had like specific rules about academic performance?
Yeah. Ours was also the 3.0. I was fortunate enough not to dip below it. I set myself at a 3.5 was what I always told myself. And being a math person, like I literally would figure out, okay, what class can I let slip and what class do I know I got in the bag? So I'm sitting pretty, right? Mm-hmm. Ours was also centered around the car insurance discount was like the good student. Right. And so it was always the, if you drop, you've got to pay the differential, right? Like you've got to get your good grades and get that discount. We'll cover it. If you fall out, like you're covering the difference, right?
It used to be a big difference too, if I remember.
It was. So, so we had that. The other one I was thinking about, I'm slipping on it now. I'm going to come back to it. There was another one you spoke to, and then I lost it as I went to the insurance conversation, but there was another one. I'll come back to it.
Was it lunch money?
It wasn't lunch money. It was, it was around, I think, the idea of again, like working, like why would you make me go to work when they're not doing well? Right. Yeah. That double up concept of like almost like a safe like area to learn that if I can't do one job well, I'm going to get myself in a hole. Mm-hmm. And I have to get out of the hole or I stay in the hole. And the only way to get outside the hole is to work twice as hard. And I've got students that do this every single semester, right? Come to me at the end of the quarter or semester, and they're like, Freeburg, what do I do to get to a D or a B or an A, whatever it is? And I think you were sharing a story just moments ago, because you finished a quarter about this too before we started the podcast. But like this idea of, yo, you didn't do work for 3 or 4 weeks. You are going to do 3 weeks of work in 1 week. Mm-hmm. Go.
You know, one other thing, and I there's, you know, there's so much really interesting information out there about like memories and how our memories work. So while I'm fairly certain that this actually was never told to me, in my brain it was. So I've held on to it as like my stepdad, my dad telling me, so part of the reason that you're doing the, you've still got your school job, you're also going to go be a busboy at Black Angus. Guess what? If you don't finish high school with good grades and you don't get into college, you're probably going to have to work two jobs. So get used to it.
Right.
As a part of that lesson. And so my second question for you was, I've been at a number of schools where we have tried to take those, I call them parent-esque permissions, right? Like those things that you get if you live in a household where like you're economically okay. And like you get those permissions, like you get to have the cell phone or the video games or whatever. Things that parents can take away also means that they're financially capable of providing them.
Right.
So talking about being at a school where we're trying to think about what are some things that we do at school that we can use some carrot and stick action on, right? So at Canyon Park, we had this thing called Knight's Day. And depending on some things, right, like you could lose out on being able to go to Knight's Day. I think we pretty much always got everybody to the finish line on that. But because nobody, from a teacher standpoint, like secret to the kids, like nobody, no teacher wants to be in that detention room on Knight's Day. Like we all want to be out making ices and stuff and playing foosball with the kids. But anyways, we were always trying to come up with different ways to create that kind of carrot and stick of fun things or opportunities at school that were based on academic success. The only one that I remember being particularly successful at Canyon Park, we had an ice cream sandwich party at the end of every, I think we were on semesters at that point, so we did them every quarter. And you could get them for most improved, right? Like anybody who made like a dramatic improvement in the grade, or anybody who had a 3.5 or more, they would have an announcement that came on at the end of the day on a Friday, I'm pretty sure. And like the last, you got out of the last half hour of class and you got to go down to an ice cream sandwich party for that. And there were a number of kids who that was a, it was a little thing, but it was a nice thing, especially for those kids who were on like on the improvement wave that like I know that there were students who that meant something to, like that was a little bit of a motivating factor, at least in terms of when they were going to do that 3 weeks worth of work to catch up, they would at least make that push at the quarter instead of waiting until the semester potentially. Have you had any success with anything like that?
Small ones in my own class, I will create headphones. Like I usually will let music and things like that go anyways, but if like I see like the class drops off on a unit because they've all started to check out too much, right? Mm-hmm. Like, yo, hey, we got to get ourselves in gear. We've got 1 week to retake this. I didn't do a good job. You know, I tried to take my ownership. I didn't do a good job of holding you accountable. I didn't put you in a good learning atmosphere. Because of that, we got to make some adjustments. Headphones off. We're out. We got to fix this. If we can hit X bar as a class, we can go back to headphones, right? And so, and a lot of times I'll get my kids, they recognize why we're making the shift. They want to fix their grades. A lot of them individually are asking, can I retake this anyways? Some of them are like, oh, I'm too cool, I don't need to do it, but they really want to anyways. And then, you know, we hunker in, we bust our tail and we go. Part of that is I like coaching math, right? Like I like, we're a team, we're going to be successful. Like you can help your neighbor understand it probably better than I can because they didn't understand it the way I said it. And so I pride myself with all my tutoring experience of being able to show it in lots of different ways, but there's also just a peer tutoring, peer teaching kind of thing, right? That we know works well the kid who teaches it learns it better. Right. Mm-hmm. So I try to teach that team atmosphere. And so that's been one, is like headphones, cell phones, tech disappears when performance drops. Mm-hmm. And if we can pick it back up, it comes back, right? So I use that one. Seeding charts is a big one. That's what I used more right now. You know, everything was so weird this year. But I've used this one definitely in the first few years I taught. Like, they loved it. This was so good. Every time we scored an 80% as a class or higher, the next day students got to sit wherever they wanted and they could lock it in for the whole unit. As soon as we dropped below an 80 on a unit test, I threw them back in assigned seats.
I like that. That's nice.
It was awesome. And they loved it because it motivated them and they helped the student that they knew needed help. And it wasn't like an embarrassing thing. It was like they literally would like work with each other. And I would, you know, try to do my normal teaching stuff too, but like, it's fun to see them. And if you can build the team atmosphere around it, right. And it's not a shame thing. It's not you ruined free seating, right. It's like, no, we didn't help each other enough to get the reward. And so, that one's worked really well. I like that one.
I mean, the power of the seating chart was something that I feel like you and I talked a lot about when we were first starting teaching, and I love using it in that way. What I really like that you're talking about, that I also think is a good segue into the non-pragmatic, for lack of a better term, part of motivating the unmotivated, is in when you're talking about like this team concept and or the idea of a learning community where everyone's working together, and having that metric be not something that individuals are getting, but that the whole, like, a class reward. Is reminding me of some of the other things that I think we need to be really aware of when we're talking about students who might be unmotivated in our classrooms. And that is understanding that, like, white supremacy culture, or just like the status quo of how like the education system works, which I think is an example of white supremacy culture, but it also impacts like students who are learning another language, students who identify as LGBTQ+ community. There are a lot of things about the structure of the school system or things that we take for granted that we don't even really realize are a part of the system that can cause a student to completely lose their motivation to be successful in school, or to even want to come to school, or to feel like school is a place that is even for them. I've had conversations with students who are just like, this place is not for me. And they can tick off all the things about this place that make it not for them. And so I think we would be doing our listeners a disservice if we didn't touch on the fact that the things that we're talking about in the first part here, with the money, job satisfaction, athletics, you know, permissions to do fun things, they're ultimately all really good strategies. I'm not saying don't use those, and really recognize that there are big things that can cause our students to be unmotivated, and we have control over some of those things.
Right. And the first piece is the awareness, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so much of this starts with, can I actually pay enough attention and listen to identify what those are or what those might be? Again, not jumping to conclusions based on our own stereotypes, right? Because we all have them from our own life experiences, and mm-hmm. start to break those down is a really good thing and a good practice. I think that there are a lot of things where it's like, once I've slowed down to figure out what the story is, or like understand the why behind behavior, the more success I have switching that up. Right. Mm-hmm. Because now it's like, oh no, I get why you're doing that. That totally makes sense, and validate. Mm-hmm. And I know we've spoken to this in the past too, right? Like, listen, validate, acknowledge all those kinds of things. And then, okay, what's a better solution moving forward? It's like the hallway conversations, all that kind of stuff. Right.
Yeah.
And so, it's definitely a place that I'm continuing to learn and grow in. And I love it. I do. Like, it's uncomfortable. And I love it, right?
That's why I wanted to give you some credit, right? Is I think the reason I thought that what you were talking about, that community learning, I think one thing that I know I felt very present in our growing up as students together at what, you know, I thought it was perfectly, like, I didn't think anything was wrong with it, but it was very clear throughout my entire education process that, like, I am individually responsible for my learning and my output. And the idea that I would use an idea that another student had in my class, or that I would work with, like, talking about I talk about our dynamic relationship, right? You have certain strengths that you bring to the table that are different than the strengths that I bring to the table. And ultimately, when we collaborate on things, we usually make something better than what would have been created, right? We did a whole freaking 2 weeks on collaborating with people as an important thing. And to then tell people, hey, you have to do all of this by yourself. One is, I think, teaching the wrong lesson, frankly. And then two, it's also something that is very clearly, I am learning, a part of, like, Western or, like, white culture, of the idea that learning happens individually. So the idea that you allow your students to work together to attain a goal is one example of rethinking what the classroom can look like, so that it's not always centering the default way that society has been designed to work.
Well, and I mean, if we look at any of the modern surveys of what employers are looking for, they're all looking for communication and collaboration. Mm-hmm. Like, if we're not teaching that in our classroom, we're definitely doing a disservice to our students. Like, they need to recognize, how do I help? How do I work together? And, like, I mean, I always hear, you know, like, oh, I hate group projects because so-and-so never does their part and I'm the one carrying the load. It's like, yes, and, you know, you're going to be in a position where you're going to carry a lot of loads for people if you're a top achiever. Mm-hmm. Just plain and simple. Get used to that. That's why you're going to make more money than your counterparts a lot of times, is because you're pulling their weight, and hopefully someone recognizes you're doing that. They recognize the value add and you get compensated. If not, go find another job and see, you know, who's valuing that. The other part of that, though, is there are people that have had different life experiences that don't know how to do all those pieces. And if you can help teach those pieces, you're going to better the entire whole. And it teaches you to be a trainer. There's a lot of good to it. I don't know if education equity or whatever is the right term there, but, like, I think when you do start to work as a group and a squad, like, you can, you know, like what's that, the phrase, when the tide goes up, all the boats rise or whatever. Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. You know, like, this idea that if we can all work together, we can all become a part of this. You're still going to have some people that, you know, are going to shine. They're going to do their thing. Yeah. But I think you get a better product out of the whole.
Yeah. And I think to even push that idea of, like, that group dynamic, because you do hear that all the time. It always cracks me up. Like, the number of students who say that they don't want to do group work because they're worried that they're going to do all the work versus how many people are. It's like, oh, 70% of the students are worried that they're going to do all the work. The math doesn't add up here. But another thing to really keep in mind with those things is for those students is, like, well, are you even giving space for someone else to try and do something, right? Like, a lot of students who are high achievers, there's a lack of trust in their peers. And so they'll think that they have to do everything when they don't. So that's right. One thing that I will challenge my students on a regular basis is, well, did you even give them a chance to do the thing that you wanted them to do, or that you're complaining that you had to do all the work for? The second thing is, with different cultural backgrounds that our students have, they might not recognize that they are someone who could insert themselves in a position of leadership or offer up an idea of what the project might look like, or to talk first, right? Might have been you, could have been another teacher I was talking to that was just talking about student from East Africa who was raised in a culture where women had some pretty restrictive expectations. And so a student who's coming from that background is less likely, I know I'm making some of these assumptions that I warned us about making in our connections episode, but when students come from a background like that, there's a chance that they might not step up to the plate unless they're pushed to, or unless the people who are used to stepping up first intentionally make space for that. And that's one of the things that I'm really pushing on. We have a rule in our Socratic seminars now, in our remote setting, And I wasn't sure I was going to go. I experimented with it second semester, and it's working really well. It's actually really interesting to listen to the seminars from first semester and second semester and see the difference in them. But we have a rule that if two people try and talk at the same time, if one of those two people is a white male, they always let the other person go first. Just that little prompt. What has also happened is that the white males in my classes have now, for the most part, practice the culture of not trying to jump in first when we have a new idea that's being discussed in the seminar. We've kind of created a space where there's a norm around waiting and letting a different voice be the one that's first. And one thing that might be interesting to you, I've been doing this with my staff meetings, and it's fascinating and also kind of horrifying. When someone asks someone to volunteer to do something, or there's an opportunity for multiple people to speak and like someone can jump in first, just track how often in a staff meeting or whatever walk of life you're in, how often that's a white male that speaks up first. It is astounding in our staff, which is like roughly 50-50. It's like 95% of the time. It is mind-blowing. So just creating those spaces where, hey, maybe sit in the background for a second. You don't have to be first. Can be a thing that can help bring some of these other voices and encourage those students who maybe didn't think that they had a role to play in that group project to actually step up and do more than you or the other kids in the class thought they might be able to do.
Right. I like that. I'm giggling here in the background. I know people can't see my giggles. You were on the screen there for a bit, but I'm always that jackass that just puts his front row. I'm like, yo, pick me. So funny. But yeah, the other thing that I was thinking of too, to help with that equal voice kind of thing that we did at Challenge Day, was everybody got 2 minutes, no matter how they use the 2 minutes. Mm. So the only person speaking for those entire 2 minutes is whoever's turn it is. And if they are not speaking, no one is speaking. We sit with full attention on that human for 2 minutes. A couple of things that we notice happen. One is that they will be quiet at first because they're testing to see if you're going to really make them talk. Two, once they have sat there for a while, they actually might finally feel comfortable saying whatever it is that's actually on their mind. And if you do this multiple times, the second or third time you do it, they're more comfortable doing it because they recognize their voice is actually equally as important. Now, on a moderating kind of side of this, right? You do need to make sure you have the firm conversation early with some of your me monsters that take over every conversation. Mm-hmm. Which was really funny because when we're sitting here talking about demographics and adults that still take over when they're adults, parents sometimes, because we had groups of about 5 or 6, one adult in the group, just for like reportability stuff that we would be sharing in those small groups sometimes. If it was silent, the adult sometimes would get awkward. And so it's like, if you, even as a teacher, can't allow awkward silence in your classroom, like mm-hmm. the 7-second rule or whatever, right? The wait time, like be aware of that, like recognize that and like practice your own, like, I don't need to fill the space. I don't need to give the answer. Just sit for a moment. And if the same kid raises their hand over and over and over, thank you. You know, I appreciate it. I'm glad you're on with me. I'm gonna let other people have an opportunity. And then let it be silent and awkward for a moment and let some of those other voices come out and give them a shot, or strategically randomly pick somebody, you know, like that's my other favorite one. And I do, I'll use a random number generator and I'll get it started. And then when I get to a spot where I know I need to pull on somebody, like, you know, that's my next random number, you know? Mm-hmm.
So real quickly, that was a strategy. I haven't used it in a while. But when I was doing junior high, someone gave me the idea of getting a tongue depressor, popsicle stick deals, writing kids' names on them and just pulling them up. And sometimes you call the name that's actually on there and sometimes you don't. But like that idea of
and you stuff it right back in the middle of the pot and no one knows.
Everybody's going to participate in class and everybody's voice is valuable. And then you don't have those kids who are like me. who are somewhat like Hermione Granger, as I'm re-listening to the Harry Potter books right now, who always have, so I always think I have the right answer, right? Hermione actually had the right answer, like raising their hand, thinking that I think I know. So I'm in the same boat with you, right? Like I have had to make a very conscious decision, and to the point that it's a little bit awkward on some of the smaller teams that I work with. I work on one where I'm literally the only dude, and I had to like tell them like, hey, I'm purposely not ever going to talk first unless I'm like directly addressed. I made that decision like in the second or third meeting. And first of all, like the amount of gratitude that I got, which was not my reason for doing it. I was just explaining like there's a reason I'm not like jumping in, is because I'm trying to not dominate the conversation, was interesting. But that is something I've been working on in that 7 second rule as well. And so I wouldn't even call myself, what would I call myself? I'm in the early stages of learning how to be a culturally responsive teacher and have culturally responsive curriculum, doing my best with both of those things and continuing to learn about it a lot. I just thought it was really important as I'm learning about that and thinking about how it impacts my own students, that is something when we're talking about students who are unmotivated, right? The system that we have in place for students who don't identify with like kind of the default culture of our schools is something that we need to recognize. And I would very quickly challenge, because this will come up, someone will say this in any walk of life that you're in, someone will say, well, they need to learn how to figure out how our culture works, right? Because that's how the culture works. So I will immediately just, you know, I think the new phrase that the kids are using is miss me with that argument. I'm not interested in hearing that because it's always been that way. It needs to stay that way, and that they need to accept it and figure it out. Right. Like let's think about maybe there are some better ways for society to work as well.
I love that. And I love how a lot of times this is how it's always been is not a very long time. Right. Like for real, right? Because this is how it's always been, and then you did something slightly different, and this is how it's always been, and then you did something slightly different, right? And like in high school and college, like this was something I preached a lot, both as a student and as a teacher, and doing some advisory and stuff for, like with my old fraternity and stuff, is like, you do not have to haze, right? Like this was a big thing when I was like, doing some of the men of principle stuff with my fraternity. Is like, you don't have to haze. I'm like, what do you mean? That's how we've always done it. How long you've always done it? Like, well, the dudes that were seniors when I was a freshman. Okay, so we're talking like at max 6 years. This is how it's always been. Well, they did it before that, and they did it before that. How do you know? Well, they told us that they did it, right? And then you have a game of telephone, and it's like, no, here's how it's always been, and check this out. Start it today, and tomorrow, this is how it's always been, right? And by the time, like, and I tell this to my freshmen and my sophomores, I'm like, if you want to make a difference on this campus, in the next 2 or 3 years, when you become seniors, those freshmen will know nothing different. Those sophomores mm-hmm. will know nothing different. And whatever you have made as this is how it's always been is how it will have always been. Mm-hmm. You can rewrite all of that in a matter of years.
That's why, like, I love teaching ninth graders.
Oh, so good. Like, so
there's,
good.
There's two things from that. I do think it's a relevant counterpoint or rebuttal when someone says this is how things have always been, to be like, yo, bro. Really the only constant in the world is change. We might not like it, but it's the only constant. And then the other thing that I have to remind myself of, because again, we've mentioned it multiple times in the podcast, we're probably pissing some people off, but like we both come from a really solid place of privilege, right? Like white males in the Pacific Northwest, middle income, higher income families, we've right. been fine. But the other thing to always remember is even if this is always how we've done it, guess what? It's always been harmful and it's always sucked for a large group of people.
Right.
So again, miss me with the, this is how it's always been. Like this is not, who cares? Because it's also right. always sucked. And it's also always meant that, and this was another thing that was important when we were thinking about it directly in our school, our student population is overwhelmingly white middle-class students. That right. is just a fact about our school. We're in Portland, but first of all, like just to be honest, Portland's one of the whitest, quote unquote, urban areas in the country. There's a reason for that, because there's a long history of racism and white supremacy in Portland that has made black people feel uncomfortable living here. So we don't have, so even though it's a Portland city school, we don't have a lot of students of color, which means that there's already a visual message being told to them about what it means to belong to this place. And you can only do something helpful for students, even if it is only 40 Hispanics or Latinx students in your classroom, right? Or in your building. Think about how much of an impact you can make if you're recognizing what they're dealing with. And that was where some of our conversations started, was we were looking at our statistics. We had this goal for our school that 95% of students finish ninth grade on track to graduate. I think I talked about this in the previous podcast, and we're at that number, but something like 70% of our Latinx students in the ninth grade are on track to graduate. I think it's actually lower than that. I think it might be closer to 50%. So yeah, like the 95% is not like we're completely ignoring a whole, it's even allowing us to ignore a whole group of our students who aren't having their needs met, right? Who aren't growing, who aren't learning. So anyways, I appreciate you giving us the time to talk about that. I think it's something that's really important when we're thinking about the motivation stuff. There are these ideas of money or athletics or fun things that you get to do that are really important and really powerful tools. And it's as powerful, at least I would say, to recognize that some of the default behaviors that we have as teachers or as people who participate in the education system that make kids unmotivated.
Hey everybody, we're going to interrupt real quick just to remind you, jump on littlebiged.com and drop your name and email into our list so that you can have access to all of our free resources. As promised, we are adding in that value of education so that you can kind of run through the math actually on breaking down. If I can just graduate high school, I'm making basically an extra $400,000, which breaks down to like $150 per class per day for my junior and senior year. Kind of a fun one. So check that out. Thanks for following us, and let's get back to story time.
Do it.
Right. And one of the ways I would like to finish this kind of out, you know, obviously story time, we love doing that, is talk about, I think, the opportunity we have as educators to generate a group motivation for an individual student that maybe has felt like they've slipped through the cracks for a very long time, and they've started to give up on themselves, and maybe a couple teachers have just kind of written them off for a while so that they get reinforced in that behavior almost, but then you get a handful of them to rally behind them and switch that behavior. And then I also, I'm going to speak to how damaging one individual can be to the group effort of motivation. And whether that's an individual student in your class that just destroys anybody who, you know, is trying to come out from wherever they are, or if it's a teacher who is very set in their ways and this is how it's always been, and I'm not flexible on this, and they didn't earn it, that kind of a thing. Right. Mm-hmm. Mine was my first year teaching at the high school level. Had a senior in my class. I'm gonna call him BL. I remember we were talking before this. I was like, I can't remember his first name because I had his sister as well. This kid was, in my opinion, a good kid, right? And I didn't understand his whole life situation. I was a second year teacher, so I wasn't asking all the right questions and diving in deep enough to really understand the full picture. But I knew enough that I knew that if I got the right connection, he would start to work for me. And I never gave up, right? And we talk about that, you know, never give up and how powerful that can be. And so, you know, week after week after week after week, no homework. I'm barely scraping by on just attempting tests, so they're not zeros. And part of that's because I'm like, yo, just put something in there so I can like try to give you points, right? And like this, the idea of like, okay, I'm trying to help. I'm here when you're ready, come back, right? And you know, he's a senior. he'd failed a lot of classes. He was like very much on the bubble of even just being able to graduate. I know there'd been a lot of conversations with his counselors about what was going to be required. And he had to pass all six classes because he was in credit recovery kind of stuff at this point. The last few classes were, you know, either an elective passing or a state requirement passing. Like he was at the very bare, like he needed all six. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, he's sitting at probably like a 35% or something in my class. And it was similar for a lot of his classes. Mm-hmm. And a bunch of us started, you know, talking, and we're like, you know, I've got this, this, and this. I think he can make it. Okay, perfect. I've got this, this, and this. He can definitely make it. Okay, I'm going to help him here and encourage him that if he can get this, then all he needs to do is knock this part out. Perfect. Okay, we got five people in. We're going, five of the six. And the, you know, he starts showing up in a different way than he ever has. And he's putting in the time, he's putting in the effort, he's asking the questions, he's actually getting to understand. I'm like, dude, this is a game changer for this kid. Mm-hmm. And like 3 weeks into it, one of the six teachers refused. They're like, no, there's no way they can ever get back to a 60%. I'm not going to pass them. They had their chances. I've been working with them. I've given them opportunities. I'm done. And like, I don't want to say that teacher is 100% wrong, but in my opinion, that's not the best play. And so I get it. You need to accomplish things at certain times. And, you know, and I love the argument, like, well, you don't have to pass your driver's test on the first attempt, right? You can eventually, you know, drive a car at some point. And, you know, and then there's the other, like, you know, like, I can't just give everybody everything, and there's got to be due dates and things like that. And I'm like, yeah, like if I go and I'm just a complete jerk to the woman of my dreams and she dumps me, it doesn't mean I'm going to be alone for the rest of my life. It just means I might not get that girl. Mm-hmm. And so, or your, you know, your partner, whatever. And I was so frustrated because like I've been putting in work. Four other teachers have been putting in work. We got to a spot where this kid game changed his entire approach to his education. One teacher held on, dug their heels, and was like, no, I'm going to hold true to my teaching belief. And, you know, this is what they had. They had their fine lines. They're infinite. But you know what ends up happening? Literally the next day, kid comes in. He's like, yo, Freeberg, I appreciate your help. So-and-so is not going to let me pass. I'm done. I'm dropping. And I was like, no, don't drop. Like, you've got 5 weeks left or whatever it was. I think it was about 5 weeks. Mm-hmm. You have 5 weeks left. Finish out whatever you can finish out. It'll make it easier to get your GED later. Never saw the kid again. Saw his sister, right? She was a sophomore. She was still working. So I checked in to make sure he was just alive and well, but just gone. Just like motivation. Finally showing up. Like, we want to talk about motivating the unmotivated. That kid hadn't done work almost all year. We finally found the switch, and then boom, it can be killed in an instant. And for me, what that story tells me is that if you tell a kid they can't do something, or they're not good enough, or they're not going to amount to something, or whatever that negative story is, and you tell them long enough, they believe it. It takes a lot of work to change that belief. Mm-hmm. And it takes an instant to put them right back in it.
Yeah, it was funny when you were getting ready to start the story. I always worry about when we use names, right? Because you worry about whether or not a student wants to be included or something like that. The name that I would be worried about now in this story is that teacher, because that teacher comes across as just, in my opinion, right? You and I obviously agree on this, just completely in the wrong of like, what? Why are you in education? Because what you did told a student was to stop learning. That was the message that you communicated then, was that they could no longer learn enough in your class to be able to get credit for moving on. So I love that story, not the story itself, because it's a frustrating story to hear about how one person digging in their heels can disrupt something for a student. And it's also important to recognize, like you said, there's probably a lot of context back there of that student being told, either by themselves or by other people over and over again, that they couldn't or they can't, or having deficit thinking for that student that inflicted. And just as it seems like the ship is about to turn course, it gets bumped it gets bumped back off, because it is, like you said, once you've kind of learned that you're not any good or that you can't, it's much easier to fall back on that when you run into another obstacle. And it's understandable that he had that reaction as well. I think it's not the reaction that we want, right? But it's definitely an understandable one. So thank you for sharing that. I hope wherever that teacher is in the world right now, one, I guess I hope they're not teaching anymore.
They should be retired at this point, just by straight math at this point. They should be well out the door. But
thank you for sharing that. I think that's a really good cautionary tale for us to finish off with. Thanks for sharing.
You're welcome. And I think the last piece I just want to throw at this motivating the unmotivated is, like, get creative. There is something there that will help you spark a connection and change a belief. And beliefs are hard to change, right? Mm-hmm. But you know, that idea of as we think, so we feel, so we act, right? And those beliefs are deep rooted in our thoughts. And so to change that belief is very difficult. But if you can get creative and find even just that glimmer that starts to think that something else is possible, run with it. It's worth it. So we appreciate y'all. Always learn in a peak state. And we'll see you next week.
Yeah, make it a great day and do that work that Tim's talking about with some colleagues so that you're not doing it by yourself.
Absolutely.